R22, tout le monde. Antenne, tout le monde.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, obviously, Aline, Marco, Beth, all the other speakers. It's been an incredible couple of days. Thank you, Eve and Caroline, for translating. I'm going to be talking about translation in a kind of expanded sense, and I also realize that my title, it sounds terrible in French, and you lose, everything gets lost in translation. So I'll get to that, I'll get to why I have this sort of play on words for the title. Also, I'm tasked with this sort of difficult position of going last, where I'm really tempted just to simply talk about everything that has already come, so I'm going to try not to extemporize, otherwise I'll be here all evening. Okay, so in March of this year, here in Paris, with a head filled with conversations around the meaning of decolonization, quote unquote, in France, the role of cultural institutions and the fashion from within the cultural industries, both French and otherwise, for difference, for the inclusion of the marginalized or the subalterned, I was listening to a brief interview with the late Nigerian curator B.C. Silva, who I think a few people in the room were quite close to. So speaking in 2017 about her practice between the local and the global, Silva's efficient eloquence regarding a well-worn yet no less urgent issue struck me. So in the video she spoke about the local within the global within the local, these are all sort of familiar phrasings, and her emphasis on the specificity of the local, albeit in the context of the global and a multitude of levels. So despite not being a curator myself, Silva's words resonated and I couldn't help but translate them into my own métier or my own milieu, that of teaching and hence of the classroom. So is the classroom local or global? And how are we to figure the relation between the local and the global from within the space of the classroom? So as I'll be coming to, besides the usual theories of globalization, one way in which I've been thinking about this, and I've been thinking about this while sort of developing curricula and teaching over the years, so thinking about a bridging or an alliance between the local and the global, and between local and global struggles on a planetary scale, is through the notion of planetarity that was developed by Gayatri Spivak, which Jennifer's already sort of introduced quite usefully. But first, to give some context, and this really is just for context, it's not marketing spiel. So the classroom that I'm speaking of is it's an MA program in postcolonial culture and global policy that I run at Goldsmiths, University of London, and I've been convening it since 2014. So initiated in 2004, actually by Françoise Verger, the program has since undergone many modifications, and for the last 10 years or so has comprised core survey models in postcolonial theory and globalization, as well as a practical element in which students are required to carry out and reflect upon a work placement or a research project relating to postcolonial issues in an expanded sense, and largely concerned with issues around activism and advocacy. So immediately at issue when I mention postcolonial here is what we mean by this term, which we can explore in the context of teaching, explore with the students in relation to the decolonial, to indigenous studies, to epistemologies of the South. So when I say decolonial here, I'm actually referring principally to the decolonial turn that came out of South America. So the work of the modernity/coloniality group, who stress the coloniality that is the underside of Western modernity, or otherwise put, as per yesterday's conversation, the toxicity or the original toxicity that underlies and sort of undergirds modernity. But of course, there are many other ways of understanding decolonial. So there's the decolonial feminism, for instance. This is something that, again, Françoise Verger has been speaking about a lot. Or decolonial feminism in the context of the US, or the distinct use of the term here in France. So decolonial or décolonisé as a verb. Quite different to how we use it in the UK. So how we use and define such markers is up for grabs and often a case of translation, both linguistic and contextual. But we might begin with the following: that the post-colonial critique, in the words of the recently departed post-colonial scholar Koos Venn, my former colleague, is about redrawing the diagrams of possible worlds. So post-colonial, the term that's prioritized in the UK rather than decolonial, can also be understood expansively, as for instance in the conception of recently passed curator of global arts, Okwe Enwizor, for whom post-colonial, quote, I'm quoting someone who was writing about a conversation with him, was always broader than the breakdown of cultural and political imperialism, instead encompassing the way the many concurrent social movements of the mid to late 20th century that chafed at naturalized hierarchies. So the civil rights movement, the women's movement, LGBTQI advocacy, environmentalism, and allowed for more social, political, and psychic liberties than had been possible for prior generations. And I mention these movements because I'll be returning to these in light of late liberalism and eventually planetarity. So if the title of this conference invites us to map geontopower specifically in relation to the European scene of late liberalism and its criticism, then a first question would be how the production of certain subjects, as mapped by Povinelli in the context of Australia and the US, translates into the vocabulary and the academic shifts of Europe, and in particular the UK, from which I speak, and France, and I'm hoping that we can discuss this more later on. So across her work on the encounters between indigenous or aboriginal subjects and settler power, Povinelli usefully maps out the various phases of liberalism, with late liberalism, in short, coming to signify the management of difference. And we've heard a lot about this over the last couple of days, but I thought it was worth just sort of clarifying the way in which the term is used, because it's used so differently in the UK and in France. And so the management of difference. So a movement of double bind in which post-war policies of multiculturalism and self-determination, often in the guise of state-led politics of recognition, in fact serve as a smokescreen for a continued, insipid, and often less easily identifiable form of dispossession. So as Povinelli explains it, late liberalism indicates a period that stretches loosely between the 1950s and the 2000s. And I quote because I think these precise words are useful, especially in terms of notions of containment or capture, as well as futurity. So sorry, Beth, I'm going to quote you for a little while because I think we need to be precise here. So Beth, the argument is that from the 50s through to the 70s, liberal governments were shaken by two severe legitimacy crises. On the one hand, anti-colonial, native, and radical social movements shook the legitimacy of paternalistic liberalism, and on the other hand, Keynesian stagflation shook the legitimacy of the capitalist management of markets. So from the perspective of these two slow-moving events, the politics of recognition and economics of neoliberalism should be seen, and here I stress, as strategic containments of potentially more radical futures. So it's unclear whether in the wake of 9/11, multiculturalism remains the key mode of containing the radically otherwise. We've already heard about this notion of the otherwise. And in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008, neoliberal market forms will mutate into something else. So, end quote. No more quoting. So in the context of education and the space of the marginalized therein, what warrants stressing is that late liberalism's governance of difference is connected to neoliberalism and the governance of markets, above all in the context of globalization. So in other words, it's connected to the capitalization and profitability of difference. So returning to Enwizor, artist Hito Steyl invokes the notion of world in a recent text written in his memory. And the idea of a world in relation to planet and globe is something that I'm slowly moving towards. She says how the loss of Enwisor is an enormous loss to the art world, of course, but indeed to the notion of a world itself. Importantly, she writes, Enwisor's view of the world differed from the liberal mantra of just adding more consumer-packaged identities. So she continues, the world that Okwe dreamed of is falling apart because of the weakness of a model of globalization that championed cultural difference and its perceived or real economic benefits at the expense of economic, juridical, and political equality. End quote. So returning to the classroom, this model of global capital that champions cultural difference can of course be detected within the national frameworks of education and its marketization. So in the UK, for instance, and I realize that things are somewhat different here in France, calls from students to decolonize the curriculum, to liberate my degree, have been interiorized within learning and teaching policy. And university portfolios, and I use that term intentionally, contain an increasing number of programs marketing themselves upon this opening up of the canon, this embracing of difference, or radicality, as some universities would like to put it. So all of this is, of course, a good thing to some degree. But of course, this decolonizing fever must also be taken with a dose of skepticism. So also as a footnote, this is just stepping aside for a moment, if I've been citing these three towering figures of the global art world and academia who've recently departed, so this is Silva, Enwisor, and Venn, and if I cite them with respect to worlds, so the idea of the world or a world, it's for a reason. So what interests me here in my ponderings on teaching and engaging with post-colonial studies are also questions of inheritance, something we've heard a lot about yesterday, and hence of responding. So questions of exemplarity, and as I hope will become clearer in what follows, questions of singularity. So in particular, the notion of singularity, not only of contexts, historical, political, and so on, but more specifically of worlds, in the plural. So each time unique and yet never fully so. And it's precisely this impossible uniqueness that I'll eventually be discussing in terms of a double movement of translation. So hence the term singularity, which I'm using in a Derridean vein here, to designate not simply the unique, but rather the fraught and unavoidable space of movement between the unique and the replaceable. So between the substitutable, between the unique on the one hand and the replaceable, the substitutable, the universalizable on the other, between the empirical and the transcendental, or the formal. And as well between the literal, quote unquote, and the metaphorical, which will be my concern when it comes to decolonization and metaphor, vis-a-vis the politics of place and the politics of the land or the geos. And also vis-a-vis a possible poetics of place. So I'm thinking about this sort of movement between the supposedly literal and that which gets derived into metaphor or abstraction. And as a footnote to this footnote, with respect to inheritance, this is also a question of the work of mourning. So here we might think of the enigmatic line of the poet Paul Celan. And I'm quoting from the English translation. He writes, the world is gone, I must carry you. So on occasion of the other's death, each time, it is the end of the world. The world, not a world, has gone. And hence the impossible work of carrying the other inside oneself, a Freudian introjection. But returning to the classroom, beside many other things, our interest lies in a post and or decolonial approach towards environmental justice that has to grapple with both the philosophical or the epistemological and the very much material and economic appropriation and ruination of the environment and its natural resources, as well as of racialized and gendered bodies. So a situation that is part and parcel of contemporary structures of coloniality and neoliberal extractive capitalism or accumulation by dispossession. In other words, our interest lies in accounting for the movement in scale between the molecular, so the corporeal or the genomic, for instance, and the planetary. So I'm thinking here also of reproductive labor in the territories of women's bodies in relation to terra nullius and colonial conquest. So, i.e. a shift in scale and levels of visibility. And most importantly for this presentation, our interest, and I'm talking about us in the classroom, lies in how disparate experiences and struggles on a global scale might resonate with each other and form the basis of transnational alliances, all the while maintaining their specificity. In other words, how shared experience might translate across contexts, albeit never fully, and how they might translate across the different disciplinary nominations that I began listing at the start. So what are called for are alliances of solidarity, particularly South-South, and this is something we've been hearing about this morning, that bridge the situated, the local, that bridge situated local experience to the global. So these alliances that enter into relation, to use Beth's terms from yesterday. So what is it, and this is indeed what we're witnessing. As Naomi Klein already wrote in the 2014 book, This Changes Everything, the time of the astronaut's eye view in environmentalism, to echo Jennifer's presentation, appears to be passing, with a new movement rising to take its place, one that's deeply rooted in specific geographies, but nonetheless net as never before. So for instance, I'm thinking here of the proposition for planetary decolonial feminisms that cut across the post and the decolonial, or rather that bring together elements from each, and that attempt to undo colonial categories of race, class, and gender. So here what many share is a critique of a micrological understanding of power. As the decolonial feminist scholar Marcelle Maissa-Cohen writes, the refusal of the micrological, to theorize socioeconomic material change on a planetary level, turns to an idealized unified consciousness of oppressed subjects and communities. And indeed, turning to Povinelli and geontologies, the return to the local is held at bay in her analysis precisely through the notions of the here-ish and the now-ish that I've chosen to prioritize in my title. In fact, I'm not sure, Beth, do you actually use the term now-ish, or am I just imagining that?
No, now-ish, here-ish, there-ish, now-ish.
Okay, you do. It's good. All right.
Okay. Ish, you-ish.
And I saw thingish in my notes as well. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, I didn't say that. So what Povinelli's work teaches us is that, above all in the context of the Anthropocene or anthropocenic and anthropogenic global climate change, just when we attempt to distinguish between different modes of inhabiting the planet in order to identify those culpable of destroying it, we find that our gaze cannot remain localized. So instead, we must look further afield. And in geontologies, Povinelli moves between the metaphors of the telescope and the binocular. And I think what the ideas that Jennifer was bringing up in terms of the gaze and sort of different modes of representation is something we can certainly follow through with. So following, for instance, the flows of toxic industries and their byproducts means stretching the local across what Povinelli calls seeping transits, suspended between the local and the global. So in other words, here-ish. I'm aware for any translation, it's probably just easier to use the words here-ish and now-ish rather than the French clumsy presque ici, blah, 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 yeah, whatever. So as such, the title of my talk, Here-ish and Now-ish in the Teaching Machine, is an intentional temporo-spatial reconfiguration of the title of Gayatri Spivak's 1993 collection of essays, Outside in the Teaching Machine. which gets totally lost in the translation. So Spivak's title had asked us to consider marginality and the position of the outsider within the teaching machine, often considered in terms of post-colonial pedagogy, and importantly for the questions that I'm slowly advancing around the misuse of decolonization talk in relation to strategic essentialism and the new orientalism of academics who were at the time, and this is in the 1990s, constituting the third world as an object of knowledge, and an object of knowledge for institutional validation and certification. So my plan is not to engage with the book of Spivak further than these comments, but I like the topological reflections of the book's title, the topological reflections that the book's title proposes or prompts, and would suggest translating these into issues around the essentialization, objectification, and capitalization of difference within academia and the arts, and translating this into a discussion of planetarity. So to turn to the question of world and planetarity, again, it is a matter of terminology, and with this of translation. So the globe, to be clear, and we've already heard about this to some degree, is not the world. So technology has changed the meaning of the earth as terra, and even as technology seems to give equal access to all, as part of a broader process of globalization, it simultaneously exacerbates inequality and perpetuates the hegemony of certain languages, primarily English. So whereas the globe refers to the entire planet, world refers more narrowly, or more narrowly connotes the world of particular species of beings or singular living beings, as such allowing for cultural and historical differences, rather than the fantasy of planetary wholeness or totality. So turning finally to Spivak's term, I'll simply summarize some of the key points which we've already heard from Jennifer's talk. So as she writes in her 2014 book, her 2014 entry to the Dictionary of Untranslatables, the untranslatable term planetarity was figured as a word set apart from notions of the planetary, the planet, the earth, the world, the globe, globalization, and the like in their common usage. So first evoked by Spivak in 1997, the term was subsequently elaborated upon at length in her 2003 Death of a Discipline, where she discusses a potential merging of comparative literature with area studies in order to more progressively approach the idea of the global, which she considers too closely tied to neoliberal discourse in its imposition of the same system of exchange everywhere. So instead, planetarity would draw on both literary and geographical studies to, as Jennifer said, to overwrite the globe in such a way so as to protect or at least to acknowledge or to be vigilant towards the radical alterity of indigenous or local voices and ways of life. In other words, the radical alterity of different life worlds. And I think this is something I'm suggesting we can think together with the kind of radically otherwise that Beth has been proposing. So the globe, Spivak writes, and this is to repeat this great sentence, is on our computers. No one lives there. It allows us to think that we can control it, or we can aim to control it. The planet is in the species of alterity, belonging to another system, and yet we inhabit it on loan, end of quote. So in other words, planetarity becomes what we might think of as an updated version of Spivak's meditation on whether the subaltern can speak for our contemporary neoliberal moment. And this is sort of also thinking about the subaltern in terms of nature, as well as the subaltern human subject. In this instance, providing us with the critical tools to address what we might call earthly alterity in the context of the threat posed to the environment by neoliberal homogenizing markets and, importantly, environmentalism. So as I read it, at least, planetarity is more of a condition or an experience or a mode of engaging with or reading, responding to, rather than simply a scalar or a topographical marker, although, of course, it does sort of help us think these things through. So in other words, it's an experience that allows us to think on a global or a planetary scale, albeit maintaining the never fully translatable aspects of singular experiences and contexts. So planetarity, Spivak tells us, is to be distinguished from contemporary planet talk, in which the planet is conceived as object, an undivided natural space rather than a differentiated political space. So this, she writes, smoothly translates into the interest of globalization in the mode of the abstract as such, susceptible to nation-state politics. It can accommodate the good policy, and I think we can add quote marks there, of saving the resources of the planet. So rather than translate into any applicable overarching environmentalist program that is played out on the level of the local, and we can think of countless global and national initiatives and policies for biodiversity and conservation that in fact work like this, to extremely problematic effect. Instead of this, planetarity would name an uncanny experience, both of ourselves and our planet as a species of alterity. So recalling my earlier discussion of the marketization of difference, planetarity would be a potential rejoinder to the global policies of managed multiculturalism and transparent identities. And instead, a mode of beginning to think together socioeconomic and material change on a planetary level, and alterity as this plays out on the level of the local. So it's for this reason that planetarity is a form of reading that resists immediate comprehensibility by the ideological average, and that's quoting Spivak, i.e. that resists translation, has been taken up for the purposes of what we can call an intra-colonized dialogue. So as a form of bridging, and this is a very rich feminist term, or what Marcela Meiser-Cohen describes as the movement of a border crossing between worlds that is otherwise unimaginable or materially foreclosed. So in her work on planetary decolonial feminisms, Meiser-Cohen uses Spivak's notion of planetarity in order to invoke a solidarity that moves beyond the United States and Latin America. So these are geographical regions with which decolonial feminism, at least in the English-speaking world, is often associated, and to move between both post and decolonial dialogues. So in this instance, planetarity names a shared critique of grand narratives, a critique that's shared both by the Argentine feminist philosopher / activist Maria Lugones, and also the Peruvian sociologist Aníbal Quijano, who we also heard about this morning, who's best known for his theorization of the coloniality of power, but, according to Lugones, is unable to fully account for the coloniality of gender. So the Latin American vein of decoloniality has tended to reject the interweaving of postcolonial theory with European high theory, so for instance, deconstruction, and to differentiate itself from what it identifies as a problematic Eurocentric critique of Eurocentrism. Instead, choosing the project of epistemic delinking from the rhetoric of modernity that enables the histories and the thought of other places to be understood as prior to European incursions, and to be used as the basis of developing what they call, the decolonial theorists would call, connected histories of encounter. So recent scholarship and activism within the field of decolonial feminism, however, seeks to bridge decolonial and postcolonial scholarship, precisely in the project of this global coalition building. And it's here that Spivak's planetarity comes into play. So as Meiser-Cohen writes, both Lugones and Quijano, and we can add to this many others, are wary of being consumed under the sign of multiculturalism or world literatures, so the latter being the object of Spivak's critique through her use of planetarity in Death of a Discipline, and find their discipline's discourse of diversity unequipped for teaching alterity to be recognized. So, returning to my earlier comments regarding the teaching of postcolonial studies and the possible pitfalls of this sort of decolonizing fever that we can see across Europe and I guess North America. I'll here rephrase this through the notion of translatability and the stress on alterity within a thinking of planetarity. So in her entry on planetarity in the Dictionary of Untranslatables, Spivak writes, "We must persistently educate ourselves into the particular mindset of accepting the untranslatable, even if we are, as we are programmed, to transgress that mindset by translating it into the mode of acceptance," end quote. So I would propose that this translatability or untranslatability also be thought in terms of the movement between the literal and the metaphorical, the specific and the generalizable. So for instance, central to Povinelli's book, Geontologies, and also the Carabing films, is an engagement not only with the specificity of place or of rootedness, but also with the environment. So the land, the fragile coastal ecosystems of the Northern Territories, rocks, earth, geological formations. So again, the land. In the context of this sort of decolonizing fever that I mentioned that's witnessed in culture and education nowadays, there's a risk of what North American critical race or critical ethnic studies and indigenous studies scholars Eve Tuck and K. Wayne Yang write of as decolonization being instrumentalized as part of settler moves to innocence. So in the US context, Tuck and Yang are quick to point out that beyond its use in sort of decolonizing our schools and so forth, decolonization is by its very structure or very nature unsettling. So that it is about the repatriation of indigenous life and indigenous land. In other words, that it is not a metaphor. As they write, and I quote, "As important as their goals may be, social justice, critical methodologies, or approaches that decenter settler perspectives have objectives that may be incommensurable with decolonization," end quote. So for Tuck and Yang, the sort of easy adoption and the metaphorization of decolonization, i.e. its uprooting or deriving from the specific conditions of indigenous life and its rootedness in the land, quote, "makes possible a set of evasions or settler moves to innocence that problematically attempt to reconcile settler guilt and complicity and rescue settler futurity." So I'm also suggesting we think this together with what Beth was saying about late liberalism and this sort of containment or appropriation of futurity. So in the face of this, they propose what they name an ethic of incommensurability that recognizes what is distinct and what is sovereign for projects of decolonization in relation to human and civil rights-based social justice projects. So while on the one hand I'm advocating for a certain translatability between activist movements globally, I'm also agreeing with the following, and again I'll quote from Tuck and Yang. "Attending to what is irreconcilable within settler-colonial relations and what is incommensurable between decolonizing projects and other social justice projects will help to reduce the frustration of attempts at solidarity. But the attention won't get anyone off the hook from the hard, unsettling work of decolonization," end quote. I.e. from attending to what is untranslatable. So this granted is in the context of North American settler colonialism, a different set of conditions to the decolonization movements both in the UK and in France. But the warnings, nonetheless, I would venture ring true in this context, at least to some degree. So as Maissa Cohen writes, citing from Boaventura de Sousa Santos's notion of epistemologies of the South, the otherness of alternative models of liberation that bear traces of non-hegemonic or subaltern thinking, be they premised on land rights or ecology or otherwise, must not be confused with legalistic, capitalistic, or moralistic cultural diversity, but instead an epistemic diversity. And I think I'll just end there because I think it's a useful way of thinking. Rather than simply pluralize or diversify, it's in, what's at stake actually is an entirely different epistemic framework, or perhaps sort of to carry on from the discussion, the first panel around sort of laws and different laws and ontologies are an entirely different framework. But of course, the question remains, well, how do we practice that from within the context of Europe? I have quite a few questions, but I'm going to leave them for the discussion. Leave it there.